At APR Energy, I'm the Chief Operating Officer. I manage the operations and business development throughout the world. APR is the largest U.S.-based power generation company in Africa. That means we have the most megawatts, kilowatts that are installed in the continent of Africa and actually operating and providing power to the people in various countries in Africa. We also are the largest foreign direct investor post-sanctions in Myanmar. We use an interesting technology. It's effectively, in principle part, the exact same engine that you would see when you fly up here on your Boeing 737 airplane. We put that aeroderivative turbine in a box. We put that box sometimes in a Russian Antonov airplane or a ship, and then we bring it over to a country like Libya, and we install it. But what we do is very large. So if you're Washington, D.C. based, you're probably familiar with the Pepco Power Station in Alexandria. It's a coal station. You see the stacks up by Old Town. That's 483 megawatts. That probably took somewhere, and I used to work for that company, 9 to 11 years to build. We installed 520 megawatts in Libya in 130 days. So that's our model. So interestingly, the panel's entitled Challenges of Generating and Delivering Electricity. I like to view APR as just a solution to that challenge. And so, you know, our proposition is that while all the longer-term initiatives related to transmission, distribution, renewables, large-scale power generation, while all of those are in process, we at APR believe that that the people in the countries we operate in need power today. And so we try to provide a large solution extraordinarily quickly. And we have the technology to do it. So I'm always going to, you know, always be focused on sort of sifting through the bureaucracy and trying to get straight to the solution. And I came from large power where all these challenges were so persistent. But at APR, we've managed to take the financing off the table, managed to take the insurance off the table. We managed to take all these traditional bars and building blocks to large-scale power, take it off the table. So when we go to a customer, we simply say, you know, a customer will provide 500, 1,000 megawatts of power. All you have to pay me is a kilowatt per hour price, just like you would pay your utility, Dominion, or whoever in the United States. That's all our customers pay us. They just pay us per kilowatt hour. And we do all the rest. We get it there, we install it, and that's what APR does. So we're obviously proud of that, and we think that it's just complementary to any solution, short, long, medium term. So with that, Dante, pass it over to you.
All right. Well, thank you, Brian, and thank you to my fellow panelists and, of course, to the American Security Project and APR for hosting this good discussion. So just a quick introduction on myself. I'm the founder and CEO of a company called the Risk Cooperative, specialized in strategy, market expansion, risk, and investments operating on a global scale. Prior to that, I'm a reformed insurance broker and risk manager, collaborated extensively with my colleagues from OPIC on helping to facilitate cross-border investments and effectively make sense of what happens when things start to fall apart. So I thought I would just give a couple of sort of opening remarks looking at, you know, the challenges from an energy vantage point, and in particular with electricity, in three sort of stages. This kind of broad picture, a narrative of it's very, very difficult to develop a country in the darkness, obviously. We have 1 in 7 people on the planet have no access to electricity. And then with it, of course, it's not enough to say that there's access. There's also, you have this dilemma of affordability, which is a challenge as well. And then you of course, have a rural versus an urban dilemma in bringing light to the world. The direct correlation to security on some of these issues is bad things happen in the dark, right? It's easy to argue that Al-Shabaab probably wouldn't be so quick to go to the seas, and piracy wouldn't be as big an issue in the Horn of Africa if Somalia had electricity, and if Somalia had, of course, all of the development that that entails. So there's a direct correlation between energy and development and security. And of course, looking at it again from ASP's lens, there's clearly a tie to American national security as well. Equally, you know, a lot of the challenges, and I think what APR just outlined is key. It's very difficult to go to a developing country and wag the finger on the model for electrifying those countries and the models. You know, they have to have a spectrum approach. You can't just sort of leapfrog into the green future when you have no base to start from. And I think what APR is doing is a fairly compelling approach in that you're building a plug-and-play platform to electrify on the spot as needed. And this is a very interesting dimension because one of the development opportunities in a lot of emerging and developing markets is to leapfrog the traditional coal-fired power plant approach and to leapfrog some of these technologies into more mobile, more distributed technologies because the grids effectively don't exist. Then I thought I would just give bring this discussion a little closer to home and talk about the Caribbean Basin for a moment where I have very specific experiences in looking at public utilities and sort of de-risking a lot of the transactions to modernize public utilities in the Caribbean, for example. So if you look at Haiti, according to research by the IEA and other groups, 20% of the Haitian population has access to electricity. Just across the border in the Dominican Republic, the figure is closer to 96%. Yet another island over in Puerto Rico, the number of access, the percentage of the population with access to electricity is closer to 100%. But then you have the dilemma that it is not affordable. On the island of Puerto Rico, which should be noted, of course, is a part of the United States as a commonwealth, the price of energy is about 3 to 4 times higher than it is on the mainland. If Puerto Rico were a state in the Union, it would be a state poorer than Mississippi. And the developmental consequences, even on an island that has a direct correlation to the United States, is real and it crowds out every aspect of the economy. So then, you know, looking at risk specifically in that context, you've got a massive sovereign debt issue. I mean, in Puerto Rico's case, it's more of a municipal debt challenge, but it's a massive challenge. You've got a publicly held utility with an $11 billion debt and an immediate need for alternate solutions that will lower the cost to the consumer and lower the cost to the government. And, you know, there's a number of solutions that are readily available but that haven't necessarily been implemented. You know, moving away from diesel-fired power plants, moving to local alternatives, propane as an example, is a bridge technology, not unlike APR's technology, where you have the ability to get lights on, and from the basis of getting lights on, you have the ability to then develop long-term sort of alternatives. And then the last remark I would make, just as my sort of opening statement, is, and this could be some research for the American Security Project to do, is that if you took a list, or a map rather, and you superimposed upon it the number of power utilities that are state-owned, and then you superimpose underneath that the percentage of the world's population that is sitting in darkness, and then one more map beneath that of sovereign risk and sort of the likelihood of bad things happening, the type of work that OPIC addresses, you would find there's a surprising correlation. And so much of the work in a utility or in energizing a nation really, really depends on risk, from the entire supply chain to the grid to the commodities that fuel how these power plants are powered. The entire equation really hinges on adequately addressing risk and putting a fixed price on that uncertainty.
All right, thank you. Yeah, John.
Great. Thank you. Thanks to APR and to the American Security Project for the invitation to be here. We are located just across the hallway, so it was a very quick walk over here today. Pleasure to be among neighbors and friends. Let me just spend a brief moment before I give you some of my thoughts on the question that's been posed here today, or on the issue. Just a brief overview of OPIC for those of you who aren't familiar with us. So OPIC is the Overseas Private Investment Corporation. We're the U.S. government's development finance institution. So for you old hands who have been in Washington for a long time and know the World Bank and the IFC well, think of us as the IFC for the U.S. government. We're effectively the private sector lending arm of the U.S. government for U.S. companies and U.S. investors looking to expand into or invest into emerging markets around the world. So we're open in about 160 countries around the world. We have a current portfolio of about $18.5 billion worth of loans and guarantees outstanding to some 550 to 600 discrete projects or investment managers around the world. So it's a pretty healthy balance sheet for a, you know, organization of about 250 people located here in this building. We've been at this for about 40 years. We began as a political risk insurance agency and really helped pioneer an industry which has really evolved and professionalized and frankly privatized in just the way that you'd like to see a private market privatize over time. We are in the process of putting ourselves out of business, as any good development agency should, in the political risk business, although there's still clear areas where we can lean in where there are risks that the private market won't take, and I'll talk about those some of those in a moment. On the finance side, we finance projects as small as $1 million all the way up to $250 million, so from small businesses all the way to quite large projects. And over the last 3 to 4 years, we've seen a real increase in our portfolio in Africa and in power and in renewable energy. And all of those things are related. There's kind of a Venn diagram of our portfolio going from 9% of our overall portfolio in Africa to 25% over the last 6 years. Our renewable energy our energy portfolio going from about 10% to about 30%. And our renewable energy portfolio going from about $10 million a year worth of investment 5 years ago to about $1.2 billion last year. And I think we'll talk again in a moment. I'm sure during the Q&A there'll be, I would expect there to be some question or conversation about the renewable energy versus fossil fuel question in emerging markets, because it largely is a question not simply of price and of technology, but increasingly of control of the means of the energy sources that developing countries have. And certainly if you look at Africa as one example, there's a lot of energy beating down on that continent every year. And the real question I think that country after country is asking is, how can they harness the power of the sun in particular, although not exclusively. Let me just stipulate something that I'm sure was talked about in the first panel, and I'm sorry that I wasn't here to see it, but that has been talked about by Dante as well. I think we should all agree, and we would all agree, that there is a direct correlation between lack of power, poverty, and security. And I think I don't want to take time laying out that path. I think we would all agree that there's a very direct correlation. And it's one of the reasons why OPEC has been encouraged by administration after administration over the years to focus heavily on power. Poor countries have a regime change on average every 7 years. Many of those regime change are not very kind to us, our interests, much less to the interests of the people whose regime is being changed. We have an interest as a nation to support more stable democracies, more stable institutions, more stable governance. That means we need to decrease poverty. That means that power is a big part of the equation. So I think that's something that we believe powerfully and strongly as an agency. One of the issues that Dante brought up and that Brian and we were all discussing prior to this conversation is a question of how do you attack a question of energy poverty or lack of energy on a continent. And I think the U.S. government has taken the approach, and I'll give an example of Power Africa, that there's really two things that you need to do. One is you need to increase generation, writ large, megawatts. The other is you need to increase access. And those two things are not always the same thing, as everyone in this room knows. If you look at the 600 million people in Africa today, in sub-Saharan Africa today, without access to power, I would imagine that this group would agree that not every single one of those individuals is going to be serviced with a high-frequency transmission line in the next 40 years, and that we are going to see some, perhaps pretty seismic change in the way that people receive electricity to their homes, to their businesses, particularly in rural parts of the world. I think APR has a solution that is part of the solution, not all of the solution, but that is part of the solution to help electrify the unelectrified, if you will, in developing countries. But I will use a very hackneyed analogy and say that I think there's a lot to be learned through the telecom revolution that we've seen sweep through Africa. And if you think about applying that to energy systems, energy services, energy provision, that's going to happen and is already happening on the ground as rural Africans receive their power in increasingly novel and innovative ways. In terms of product innovation, let me tell you from the perspective of a slow-moving government bureaucracy, Brian said in his remarks, he's trying to sift through the bureaucracies. Well, we are part of that bureaucracy, which requires sifting through from time to time. Let me tell you some of the obstacles that we see when we enter a market or when we look at a market and some of the challenges that we seek to overcome with our clients or that our clients ask us to help overcome. Those include such things as usually fairly opaque, difficult to understand, enabling environments on the policy front. Usually utilities that are poorly managed, oftentimes bankrupt, oftentimes with very poor management structures internal to them, that we are being asked to finance companies selling into those utilities. And of course, we are, as the lender, on the hook in case that utility doesn't make good on its pledges. So as a U.S. taxpayer, you should applaud our being at times slow and cautious as we look at the creditworthiness of off-takers around the world who are going to be receiving in, sometimes for 20-year periods, the power that our clients are selling in. So we certainly focus to a great extent on the creditworthiness of the off-takers. We look at currency issues. Currency issues are probably the biggest headache, the biggest devil in this game. What happens to currency? Many power purchase agreements, the good ones, have off-take agreements that are denominated in U.S. dollars. Of course, that puts the risk heavily on the consumer in those countries in the case that their currency depreciates. In the event that the power purchase agreements are not denominated in U.S. dollars and are denominated in local currency, we as an agency and you as taxpayers are on the hook for those risks. So we spend a lot of time thinking about how do we hedge with our clients and with other partners currency risk. And I would say that APR is a good example of one of the areas where we see perhaps the biggest problem, and that is that there are not a large number of developers in this area. When I say this area, I mean in emerging markets, you know, U.S. companies investing into emerging markets to deploy generation capacity. APR is an exception. There are relatively few of them. And so we are actively working to encourage companies who have been traditional investors in the OECD countries and in emerged markets to look at emerging markets as attractive markets. I'll conclude with one reason why they are attractive markets. If you look at the next energy projections for the next 40 years, no one knows exactly what's going to happen, but we all know that demand growth in emerging markets is going to far outstrip demand growth in developed countries. 90%, conservative estimates are that 90% of incremental power generation between now and 2040 will be in non-OECD countries. So if you're a developer, if you're a company looking to sell materials in or supplies into the power market, and you're not looking at emerging markets, you are missing a tremendous opportunity. And I think the one area where, or one of the many areas where the administration's Power Africa initiative has actually done a tremendously good job is by showing that there is real intentionality and long-term interest from the U.S. government in seeing increased investment into the power sector in Africa. And so now we are seeing suppliers, vendors, and power generation companies that hadn't previously thought about investing in Africa coming to our door, knocking on it, and say, hey, listen, we'd like to have a conversation about a project in country X, country Y, country Z. So happy to say more about that effort during a Q&A, but I thank you for the invitation to be here and look forward to the conversation.
Oh, thank you. Faith?
So I'm Faith Cornell from the State Department's Toddler-Aged Energy Bureau. We turned 3 years today. And I thought I would also spend a few minutes describing our work, since I'm not sure how many of you are familiar with ENR, as we're known in its acronym, for the Energy Resources Bureau. But it really came to fruition in terms of the recognition of exactly the links between energy, national security, geopolitical influence, and conflict that emerges from energy. We can only look at Russia-Ukraine as one example, to the affordability and import dependency issues associated with the Caribbean as another example. Many of the security links have already been discussed with respect to electricity, but other images or examples that come to mind are Pakistan, for instance. When we think about the strategic energy dialogue with Pakistan, a lot of that comes from the strategic security interests that our government has in seeing Pakistan not have inadequate access to electricity or shortages be one other reason for instability. Another example is Central America. You have countries that have huge insecurity, citizen insecurity issues, and big public finance requirements to improve security, that were using public finance or sovereign debt to repay the Inter-American Development Bank for a transmission line that has been under construction for about 20 years and finally was finished last month, the regional CPAC line. But the links between how you get the other generation and transmission capacity that's needed in those small markets that will have a hard time attracting investment because of the security risk and because of their small scale means that we can't rely on, we need to help them use public finance or multilateral development bank finance to get new generation and transmission capacity into those systems. The office I work in is called the Office of Electricity and Energy Efficiency, EEE, or triple E, but essentially is looking at all these policy issues that have emerged in the panel already, but how do you get a solvent, commercially viable market? How do you promote cost-reflective tariffs? We prioritize the emerging markets because the capacity is in a lot of need for electricity to promote economic development and competitiveness, and also because of the links to climate change. If you think of the growth, and in particular Asia, most of the coal generation expansion is happening in the Asian markets, and the links between energy and climate are very astutely clear, and our team works very closely with the Special Envoy's office, Special Envoy for Climate Change office. So a lot of what I had planned on talking about has, of course, been covered, so a few things I will just emphasize. We look a lot at the International Energy Agency's forecasts for power sector investment requirements and demand growth. As John said, nearly all of the growth is in the non-OECD, so those markets are the markets of tomorrow, and they present the greatest challenges from an investment perspective, policy, regulatory framework perspective, and these are things that the State Department engages in through our embassies, through our energy policy dialogues, through clean energy partnerships, Power Africa. There are two similar ones for Asia and the Western Hemisphere that President Obama launched. And looking also at the WEO that just came out within the last month, the positive story is that the IEA does see significant transformation underway, that by 2040, the new timeframe for the forecasts, fossil fuel share in generation will decline, with gas, nuclear, and renewables finally making up more of the global electricity supply than fossil fuels. Renewables and hydro are estimated to triple by 2040 and overtake coal as the largest source of electricity. From a national security, climate change, and electricity security perspective, this is very positive. But for all of the reasons that bringing in investment to an emerging market are difficult, it's unclear to us that the $20.8 trillion that the IEA says is needed by 2040 to keep up with global power demand. There's still a lot of work to attract that investment. Some of the examples I was asked to talk about were Asia, Middle East, North Africa, and part of South America, knowing that Dante covered the Caribbean. I've already touched on Asia, but would just emphasize that we see that as perhaps the most critical region given the growth in emissions from coal-related capacity. Middle East and North Africa is very interesting, obviously huge geopolitical strategic region for the United States, but the renewables deployment is minimal at best, and only three countries are responsible for most of that clean generation capacity. At the same time, you have Saudi Arabia with a more than 40 gigawatt goal of renewable energy capacity, and a concern that because energy subsidies and domestic oil use for power are so high, that they could potentially in 20 years not have enough oil to export to global markets, which is having the Saudis recognize that and take serious steps or ambitious goals to get 40 gigas of renewables is a great opportunity for the U.S. private sector. In Central America, I touched on that as well, but these small markets present the challenge that comes with lack of scale, a difficult security environment, an inability to trade electricity over more than 1 year. And in our engagement, we are regularly emphasizing that if you are to attract investment in a 20-year power plant, or if they want to introduce natural gas to the electric system, you have to think beyond more than 1 year. You have to make the signals very clear that this electricity will be exported to other markets, because even in Panama, which is creditworthy, which has the largest market of the Centrals, maybe tied with Costa Rica, you do not have enough demand to justify an LNG investment. And at the same time, you have a small country like Guatemala that has the potential for what we think is a significant gas discovery in the Petén. Why would you seek an LNG terminal if you perhaps have significant resources in Guatemala, or the potential to import U.S. or Mexican gas, given the private investment that we expect to occur in Mexico's power sector and the pipelines that the U.S. and Mexico are in the process of permitting or expanding? So the State Department's mission is all of those policy entangled webs of stronger policy and regulatory framework, catalyzing investment, and where appropriate, looking at regional market integration so that electricity networks are not just confined to one small market, but that there's opportunities for trade that can have a lot of benefits for the smaller, very vulnerable island states or small markets like Central America, parts of Southeast Asia. Thanks.
Thank you for that. I appreciate the comments from each member of the panel. Dante, your comments about bad things happening in the dark resonate with us, and economies not being able to grow in the dark. Right when we were discussing this was years ago, after the fall of Gaddafi in Libya, we're having discussions around our capability and be able to provide power to the Libyans very quickly. And with the then prime minister, and he was talking about how the challenges that his citizenry are going to go through writing the Constitution. And I think one of the last things I ever said to him is, Your Excellency, it's extraordinarily difficult to write a Constitution in the dark. Mm-hmm. And I do think that had something to do with our closing our deal. It ended up becoming a buzz phrase. And then, of course, John and Faith, the efforts that that OPIC and the State Department are doing on behalf of everyone to electrify these underserved markets is extraordinary, and I think everybody appreciates that. I know you want to ask some questions. I'll start off with a couple, and I think they're related. I hope they are. John, you were talking about attractiveness, making these markets attractive, and I concur with you that Power Africa has raised the visibility. Interestingly, what we found is after the fall of Enron, the full Enron effect in 2003, what happened was I'll call it 300 megawatt space. Now I think it's 500 megawatts. The sub 500 megawatt space became absolutely vacant. So in order to get the attention of the large IPP, those that were remaining, Marubeni, AES, or the large utilities, RWE, Eon, they just weren't going to touch anything that small. Yeah. It just didn't move the earnings needle. I actually still see that to this day. I mean, we talk to these larger utilities, and it's all about portfolio effect. So I have one question around what can we do? Because large utilities are not a competing interest to APR. We want large utilities in building large capacity. We hope to bridge that construction period with our solution. But what else can we think to do to convince them? And I had difficulty doing this in previous capacities, trying to convince my own company that if we get a portfolio of these together, all of a sudden they're kind of big. So, APR is now operating 880 megawatts on the African continent. Well, that was a lot of small blocks, because Africa is an example, and it could be Indonesia as an example, Philippines, archipelago nations, they're not built on these large blocks. They're built on small blocks of power. It's easy to talk about Inga and DRC solving all the problems in the world, but we're going to be talking about that for many years, and I hope it does happen at some point. So one, how can we encourage? And then related to that, and John, I think this goes to you. We think in terms of risk mitigation around portfolio of, interestingly, shortening term. So the less term you have out there, theoretically, should reduce risk as long as we can repay the loan. And coupled with a technology that, unlike the permanent space, you can actually take with you. So let's say the utility defaults and we're the project sponsor. Well, you don't just have the contract as your collateral. You've always had the assets, but these assets you can actually pick up and take with you. So the specific question is, have you thought about what the minimum term, assuming coverage ratios hit your credit committees, minimum term, because I think that there are projects out there in these markets in this space that sort of are 5 to 7 years where I can think of many different kinds of technologies that we would consider You know, just interested in specifically how, because I do think it would attract a larger space if you didn't always have to look at a 20-year horizon. And then the last thing, just for the benefit of the audience, we talk a lot about emerging and developed markets, developing markets. You know, and I'm always talking to our customers about this, and I find myself saying, look, it's not just your countries. We're facing the same thing. The demand for APR's product in the United States would astound you. UK is projecting less than 3% reserve margins by the end of next year. So it's happening in developed markets as well. And is there any I don't know, mandate within your agencies or the State Department for these developed nations as well? So, try not to ask too many questions, but I don't know how you want to handle that. But
maybe I'll just start with with a couple thoughts, and Faith and Dante can fill in if I don't speak to. So on the first point about kind of that empty middle, right, that under 300 or under 500 megawatt hole, I totally agree. We definitely see that with a couple of exceptions. Over the last decade, there have been a handful at best of US companies looking to kind of service that space. So agreed. I would also say that there are more and more, there is a movement afoot that we see, and we see on our balance sheet, and we see in our project pipelines for more companies that are looking at that space because they realize that it is in many ways the sweet spot in many emerging markets. And I think the successes that you have had and that other developers and other, frankly, OPIC clients have had over the last 5 years show that you can make money and do well in that niche. So I think your observation is right. I think the times are changing, and I think that's a good thing for all of our interests. With respect to the question on the short-term, the short-termism of a loan, I mean, clearly, if you can show us or any other investor that you can do in 7 years what normally would take 10 years and you can pay off a loan in 7 years, that's a good loan, right? And that's one that's generally easier to move through credit committees, easier to get approval for. My sense is in the power business, particularly in many of the markets in which we work, that's easier to do if you have a defined off-taker that might be an industrial off-taker or some sort of, right, where you're not necessarily selling into the local or to the state grid. Mm-hmm. You might correct me on that, but my sense is that the more confident the offtaker, the shorter the tenor of the loan can be. And I think in many times we're seeing that with dedicated offtakers that is someone other than the state or national utility, which is a fine product and something that we support. But is perhaps different from what many people are doing when they go into a market trying to sell into the central grid.
Yeah. Okay. What about on the, and I don't know if Faith, you may have a view, on the more developed markets?
Our team, the electricity team, prioritizes emerging markets because the needs are so much greater and the impact on foreign policy is stronger. But I didn't mean to suggest we don't focus on Europe. I mean, European energy security couldn't be more critical to foreign policy at this point, given the crisis with Russia and Ukraine. We have talked with a number of investors, too, looking at the potential to mobilize institutional investment. And, of course, the frontier markets for them sometimes are part of Europe, which for us reminds us of the challenges in trying to mobilize finance for some of the least developed countries. So our bureau as a whole absolutely looks at developed, developing markets. But when it comes to increasing access, addressing issues of affordability, it's more acute in emerging market contexts.
So questions, please. Yeah, go ahead. I don't know if we're passing microphones around. There's a gentleman.
Okay. Yes, my name is Yaya Fanusi, and this is for the three of you, tangentially for you. I represent United States of Africa 2017 project, and that's what that means. 2017, there will be a referendum on the Treaty of Federation in which the voters in 45 countries in Africa will vote yes to be like United States of America Federation, not European Union, 1 billion plus people. 1 billion plus people. What that means for you in your risk assessment and attracting institutional investors for what you're trying to do? And also for you, because you're talking about the small countries in Central America.
Well, I mean, I'll take a crack at that question. The I think it was absolutely observed in the earlier commentary that you heard that from the prospects on power between now and 2040 to, in my opinion, every other segment of the economy, this is the emerging and developing market century. And so what you're outlining, kind of this federated model in Africa or even regional economic blocks like they're doing in East Africa right now, there's strength in numbers, and there's a certain advantage you know, to John's remark earlier about telephony, that it's, you know, when you, with the advent of the mobile phone, you get to leapfrog over fixed line telephony. And I think the same holds true for the energy sector, the same holds true for many segments of the economy in developing and emerging markets. And so there is an advantage in starting, so to speak, at the bottom. And now we're starting to see that the type of investments that are being attracted to these markets are not just extractive and energy-based and resource-based investments, but companies like Walmart are looking at Pan-African investments because there's a nascent retail market in there, and there's a whole school of thought and a lot of that is informing a lot of business strategy around miniaturizing your products to tap into a retail market and reaching the fortune at the base of the pyramid. So I'm a real optimist about the business opportunities, particularly in Africa, and where you can de-risk things. I always tell all of my investor friends, if I can give you a fixed price on uncertainty, many parts of Nigeria become investment grade. And that's precisely the type of service that OPIC's political risk practice is offering the market.
Yes, sir.
One of the panelists here talk about lessons learned from Germany. We've been told that Germany wanted to get rid of the nuclear power stations and probably energy via fossil fuel, and then they are to focus more on renewable energy. And come to find out that you really can't do that, because when the sun goes down and there's snow, you go back to old-time religion, and then that means that you have to go back to countries neighboring and place we need power from you, coal-fired, and so on, which drive the cost. In terms of risk and affordability and what really makes sense going forward to some of the developing countries, can you address as to what should be the real model here? Because we're talking about renewable and fossil fuel going down in 40 years, maybe, but that's still very cheap. How do you motivate countries to go in that direction?
So I can take a first stab at that. Germany is a really interesting example because of its successful penetration of renewables. But as, you know, a per capita basis, strong OECD country, the feed-in tariff system allowed consumers to pay more for renewables. Renewables today, the costs continue to decline. So we like to think it is no longer just an OECD phenomena that renewables are cost competitive in most markets. But post-Fukushima, and as you mentioned, you know, the nuclear phase-out, Germany's put in a lot of coal capacity and still might, because at a certain point, German businesses and German competitiveness were impacted by increased electricity prices post-Fukushima. There's opportunities to answer Brian's questions earlier that the Germans are considering some modifications to their electricity market design, and these are opportunities where the U.S. government would certainly engage with our German counterparts to help to the extent that, you know, U.S. assistance is helpful in informing their policymaking process. But there is no one size fits all. Every government has a suite of options to consider based on the availability of domestic resources, based on existing interconnections with neighbors that might give it opportunities for import of electricity. But even, you know, with traditional oil and gas, countries sometimes are very uncomfortable becoming too dependent on their neighbors for electricity. So they're comfortable importing some, but usually like to secure domestic demand before they become too dependent on their neighbors. But options of increasing capacity in the domestic market, increasing through interconnections the ability to swap electricity, and thinking through what's the right suite of fuel options is both a political and economic and a national security decision for most governments.
I'll just give a quick response to that. I mean, I'm of the view that when the definitive book on humankind's response to global warming and climate change is written, I don't know whether that's in 10 years, 20 years, 50 years, there will be a chapter on a global financial crisis, which led to what will be seen then as, 50 years from now, as very forward-leaning Chinese supply-side policy to generate a ton of solar capacity. At the same time, there will be seen, as Germany was putting inside, what will be seen as very forward-thinking, progressive demand-side policy to procure that stuff, which happened to be coming from China, although Germany didn't know it at the time. And the combination of those policies and the financial crisis that frankly drove them in some ways has been the single biggest driver of costs coming down far faster than anyone realizes. Mm-hmm. You know, the IEA, every year they go back and they re-estimate. They have to do backwards re-estimates on the speed of renewable energy penetration in the mm-hmm. world. And they're not 1% re-estimates. They're 10, 15, 20% re-estimates year to year on how fast this stuff will deploy, and it's entirely cost-driven. Right. It's not entirely cost-driven. It's largely cost-driven, also business model-driven. Right. So I think the question, what clients come to us and say is, hey, listen, we were talking to you 2 years ago. We did some modeling with you, and we realized this project wasn't cost-effective. We're back. It's 18 months later. The cost of those panels, mm-hmm. those turbines, whatever it is, have come down sufficiently so that this is now a bankable business model. Mm-hmm. And that is particularly true in developing countries where the enabling infrastructure to just plug power into a grid is not as advanced. So, you know, this is not a space where the answer today is going to be the same as mm-hmm. the answer even in 6 months' time, but we know the trend line is like this on renewables. And I would just say, you know, continue to kind of watch this space. It's not the answer, but it's an increasingly big part of the answer.
Thank you. Yeah. Oh, I'm sorry, Renee. Second row, there you go.
Mr. Morton, thank you very much for that comment. Feeds into how is, with all this rapid change, at least two people are specialized in risk profile or risk thinking, how is the risk for large-scale capital investments in fossil fuels changing in your mind for international investment?
It's a great question.
Do you want to start?
Yeah, sure. I mean, like I said, I think at the outset, you know, if you had to pick a more risk-prone space, especially for the types of risks that OPIC is here to address, you couldn't find one more emblematic of risk than the energy sector. Something like 27 to 40% firms in the energy sector, especially in developing and emerging markets, are state-owned enterprises. So from the outset, you have a very risky industry with most of the assets that you're taking, with APR perhaps being the one exception that can, you know, unplug the system and take it away. But you have an entire industry whose business model depends on putting assets into a country permanently. Most of the stuff that you bring along with you on the ride of electrifying a developing country is on a one-way trip. And all of these assets are expensive. And all of them are not only just capital intensive from the asset side of the balance sheet, the permanent fixed assets, but they're human capital intensive. Often you need to bring in your teams of engineers and your teams of expats and so on and so forth to keep these operations running. And then your counterparty is a mix, right? Often it's the state, often it's the local power grids, often it's businesses that are also relying on these things. And you cannot decouple countries from companies, right? So when a challenge hits, like an Ebola crisis, that, you know, effectively it's the equivalent of a biological atomic bomb going off, there is no damage to property. The assets are still presumably in perfectly good shape. But your ability to carry on the business and rely on the cash flows on which the entire model is being made over a very long time horizon is no longer possible, right? So I think the risk proposition for these antiquated approaches is starting to shift in favor of alternatives, where because they're largely, they carry, in some cases, a much smaller footprint, again, not unlike APR's approach, and because they have this opportunity to connect distributed economies, right? So rural electrification is an attractive proposition. I think in some respects, the risk in those new approaches is lower than the traditional model. You know, the traditional model is being upended. The United States, in the not too distant future, by 2020, will be a net exporter of energy. This has a very, very powerful effect on the traditional energy markets in terms of their costs, in terms of the cost of generation. I think we'll have a more even hand, and I think my colleagues from the State Department would agree, we'll have a more even hand in American foreign policy and what is driving our foreign policy, in particular towards the Middle East and OPEC nations. So I think, you know, anybody sitting back on the sidelines with an antiquated technology, not embracing alternatives, not embracing renewable energy, may be resigning themselves to obsolescence in the next decade.
Hello. Hi, thanks for that. Yeah, great presentations. Sasanka from Oxfam. I actually spoke on the first panel, and I gave serious props actually to OPIC's greenhouse gas cap, because I know that, you know, the 10 million to the 1.2 billion. I'd be curious to know this for the whole panel. You know, how important are sort of market regulations like that in trying to spur the type of promotion of renewable energy? I sort of made the case in the first panel that from a development perspective, there are far more less damaging impacts of renewables and from an access perspective. But how important are those market interventions? So, you know, from the State Department perspective, we have the China-US agreement, mm-hmm. the 20%, which mm-hmm. is around 1,000 gigawatts. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's huge. Mm-hmm. You know, how much of this do we need to see that? And I guess specifically from OPIC's perspective, was that a big factor in that growth?
Just to clarify, your question is market intervention to set targets for renewables deployment or emission reductions?
Or
both?
Yeah.
Oh, it's critical. I mean, there's 100 and something countries, maybe 120, that have set renewable energy policy goals or targets. Because they are set does not mean they are implemented, but it's critical because that's how, you know, a lot of times from a foreign policy perspective, we can give advice and we can try to steer investments towards cleaner energy infrastructure, but at the end of the day, the policymakers in the foreign government have to also have the political will to make those decisions. And so when they set their own renewable energy or clean energy targets, that's a much helpful starting point because we are then coming in to help them achieve their own goals. Emission reductions, you know, those can be achieved in various ways. So just because they exist doesn't necessarily mean it's mitigation, clean energy, or efficiency. But generally, you know, that's critical. It's a critical pillar of global climate negotiations. It's critical to energy security. Vice President Biden announced the Caribbean Energy Security Initiative several months ago to help the Caribbean islands reduce their oil import dependency through renewables development, something that OPIC and the State Department and other agencies are working on closely together. That's an example where, through mitigation techniques, you're advancing energy security through renewable energy resource development. But that's the policy and political will is, I think, very critical.
Maybe just a really quick comment, but then also just really quickly to the previous one, I try to square these two different questions. I think fossils are going to be around for a long time. I don't think anyone up here is suggesting that fossils are going away and that there's no role for government support for fossil fuel industry. The U.S. government is heavily involved in supporting both R&D, but also the expansion of fossil fuel development, not only in this country, but in other in developing countries. I think to your question, however, I think an investor who treats a fossil, an investor who considers an investment for a 20-year period, who is putting a zero price on externalities related to carbon, is not a shrewd investor. And that's not a green person saying that. That's a former finance person saying that. There are costs to carbon that will be internalized at some cost over the coming years. And if you're an investor, you have to think a little bit about that in making decisions. And there's a lot of thought being given to this at the pension fund level among very senior executives about how much, where do they break on the fossil versus renewables distinction. And I think another reason it's critical in the work that we're in is because it's reasons that both Faith and Dante have mentioned, where if you are a country located here and your fuel supply, your fuel stock is located here and it has to pass through six borders to get to you, forget about the externalities of carbon. There are externalities of policy, of politics, of regulation that have to somehow be factored into your decision. And so it's not simply enough to put up a facility and assume that the fuel stock that you can get today is going to be the fuel stock that you can get even 6 months from now.
Exactly.
And I think that's a very critical piece of this conversation. The closer you can get to producing and owning the means of production in your country, the safer you will be from a national security standpoint, from an economic standpoint. To your question on the OPIC carbon issue, there's no doubt that when Congress put this carbon cap in, which has been lifted temporarily by the current Congress, that was a forcing function for us to look towards more renewable energy. Absolutely no doubt. So yes, government actions like that have an impact on portfolios.
I think we have time for one more. Is that right?
Mike Catalano with Beechwood International in London. I was intrigued by John's initial comments regarding the telecommunications industry, and this question might be to you, Brian, because you have an experience in the telecom industry. To what extent, maybe pontificate on what those possibilities are for mobile virtual network operator models, or MVNO models, to provide an example of the potential for reaching that last mile for just not necessarily large amounts of distributed generation, but certainly access to electricity. And I point to some trends, South Africa to start, and Indonesia, perhaps in the terms of the prepaid electricity market. Yeah. Prepaid mobile has seen the expansion from 1 billion to 6 billion in terms of mobile subscribers. So what are the potential innovations there for that last mile in terms of purchasing or progressively financing distributed generation and storage?
Yeah, I think it's a fascinating model. I obviously came from the largest ethnic MVNO in Europe. So when it comes from on the telecom side, the ability to use purchasing power to buy a basket of minutes or a basket of kilowatts and then redeploy and resell those, the model works 100%. The distribution vehicle, I'm not there yet. I'm not certain. We looked at all, being a vertically integrated utility in Cameroon, we looked at every way that we could every innovative way at the time that we could distribute power to that last mile, both in the rural electrification side of our business and the prepaid model side of the business. We were doing things at the time. We were even trying to lever off our network to support mobile telecom by installing fixed line wires across our distribution network just to be able to add more nodes. So I think the point is the innovation capability and desire certainly there. John may have or Faith have a different view, or even our entrepreneur here, as to how you get it there. But I think economically the proposition is clear. I would certainly sell kilowatts to a third party to redistribute those kilowatts in any vehicle whatsoever. And I think that in bulk you could do that and make it extraordinarily attractive. So it's a fascinating model to take the telecom MVNO. And you've always had third party distribution in privatized systems, but I think there's room for innovation there. I think we have to close it out. We're past two. Is that right? Do I have a time meter here? Okay. Is there another question before I close it up? Or, yes, sir?
Sorry to ask a second question. Back to the fate and Prabhu Dante. What is the interest in OPEC countries in investing in renewable when they know that fossil fuel is the way of life and has been for them? Why should they take money there and concentrate on on a new technology that will cost them a lot of money and take away from whatever is they have planned for the country.
I'm sure there are many reasons to explain the interest, but energy subsidies in the MENA, Middle East, North Africa region are very high, highest among the world. Subsidizing energy use only encourages more of it and more demand, which takes away the ability for those economies to export more oil to global markets where they get a higher price. So renewables, from one perspective, is a way to preserve the ability to export into OPEC. But I think it's broader than that, too. I think that there's a value in diversification. You can see in some of the Middle East countries that don't have oil, not everyone does. Jordan, as an example, renewables is, for them, energy security. So I think subsidies and the abundant supply of fossil fuels have created a huge domestic energy demand that has now convinced some leaders that it's important to also look at renewables.
Well, and just to add a remark about that. So you basically hit the issue on the head, which is it's a matter of disruption. That, to John's point, in the long arc of energy development and history and innovation, we're going to look back at this period of time like the period where 1,000 flowers were blooming and the market will choose which ones are the winners. So we're sort of in an energy standards war, for lack of a better word. And all of the places that are now net exporters that are sitting on these fuels with no national incentive to innovate or to remove subsidies, because let's face it, it's an instrument of the state. If you suddenly remove a subsidy, you're going to have a lot of people on the streets. You might not get reelected and things like this. And so there is no real incentive for the folks that stand to get disrupted to change the model or necessarily embrace alternatives. But the resources are there to do so. And, you know, much like what APR was doing 5 years ago, or anything near this innovative and with the capability to put it in as many places on the planet as they can is unthinkable 5 years ago. And so we're in a disruptive era right now in terms of energy alternatives. And I think soon enough will, you know, emerge that is localized and that is regionalized and taps into the most abundant resources locally because of the supply chain risks that John rightly pointed out.
I would also say, and I should have said this, renewables are more cost competitive too. Yep. You know, as the prices fall, I would assume that's got to be a driver as well, that they're cheaper than they were 5 years ago, 10 years ago. Yeah. Bloomberg New Energy Finance just conveniently did an entire report on the MENA renewables market right before, as I was preparing for this. And if it's helpful, there's 224 gigawatts of generating capacity from renewables, which only accounts for 4% of the region's electricity demand. Mm. Egypt, Morocco, and Israel make up 77% of that amount. So if you think of Saudi Arabia's target of 41 gigawatts, it's incredible.
Okay, well, thank you. A few takeaways. I think that the panel has clearly demonstrated that the link between national security, geopolitical security, and energy stability is undeniable. That's clear. That the solution is also comprehensive. It involves everything. I don't think anything is mutually exclusive, and I think that's crystal clear, whether it's a fast-track solution or a permanent solution, whether it's transmission or distribution, whether it's renewables or fossil fuels. I think there is a place for all of that in this basket of overall solutions to electricity penetration. The policymakers, key stakeholders, private and public sector in the room, and everyone should certainly recognize the passion, expertise, capability of OPIC, State Department, and other agencies within the U.S. government's remit and their dedication to serving all of us. And our common objective is clear to me, and it's clear to everybody that we come across. And I would say, lastly, that the private sector is open. You know, I'm encouraged to hear, and John would know, and I know several of the companies he's talking about this renewed interest following the heyday of the IPPs in the 90s to reinvest in this sector. And I think that's fantastic. And that's the ultimate solution, because I think all of us up here, all of us out there, anybody who is plugging an iPhone or a phone in every night knows that when you put a kilowatt on the system, you know, it just breeds another kilowatt, and notwithstanding demand-side management and the importance of that. So the issue for me and why I think APR is climbing in this space is that supply side. So everything you're hearing today is just supportive of that. And then the overall macroeconomic outlook and the comments that Faith had about these governments, and she certainly has expertise in that, is just supportive of the fact that anything that makes sense is going to play, you know, play out in the future, and that's what we count on. So with that said, I thank the panel members. I think it was extraordinarily interesting. Thank you. Thank the ASP for hosting this. Thank you.